I'd like to turn to this area in Leviticus that we read a little of just a short while ago. Really the area from chapter 11 through to chapter 15. And I don't feel that we can move on beyond this. I think sometimes the sort of section that I read in chapter 11 is often the kind of writing that many people recall from reading the book of Leviticus and wonder why we should read through in such kind of detail. Why does the Bible, for example, have a list of all those birds, different birds, naming them? Not always translating easily from the Hebrew into English. Nobody's quite sure, for example, what the fisher owl might be. But why have these things here? Let's look at this and see if we can come to some understanding and of their value for us today as well. Just to go back a little, Leviticus begins in a section dealing with sacrifices. And sacrifices are largely concerned with the, in fact always really, I guess, concerned with the relationship of man to God, and especially with the concern for the holiness of a man, the purity of a man coming to the Lord. That a sacrifice was necessary for atonement, to be made right with God, a holy God. In order to have the sacrifices, it was essential for there also to be a priesthood, those who would sacrifice on behalf of these, of the offerer, the one who was required to bring the sacrifice. The priest would do it, and the priest had to be himself consecrated in a very special way to be equipped and ready to do that work. It was not just for any person at that time to come and to offer the sacrifices. When you see the measure of consecration that was required for Aaron and his sons, it was not a small thing by any means. So reading up to this point, up to chapter 10 particularly, there is already very heavy emphasis upon the holiness of God and the necessity of man to approach him with, as the psalm calls it, pure hands, clean hands and a pure heart, purified. And so that's where Leviticus goes on next, dealing with not just the priests, but for all of Israel, that there are certain aspects in which they had to be particularly careful for the sake of cleanness or purity. And I put this under the heading of Old Testament religion and purity, while most of these sections are talking about what you eat, how you live, about skin disease. Not just skin disease either, but a disease even on clothing, mildew and so on. These are all things there. They're part of what we might think of as normal life. I was just speaking to someone very recently about the matter, and I said, "Well, don't forget to pray about it." He said, "Oh no, these things are just fun." As if to say, you don't need to pray about it. Things that are just fun. They're not spiritual matters, it seems. But I think Leviticus here is showing us that what you eat is a spiritual concern. How you behave is a spiritual matter. But to get there, we do have to go through some very practical arrangements. And it deals, first of all, in chapter 11 with that section that we read. The Lord, speaking to Moses and Aaron for the people, is dealing with food, the things that you eat, animals in particular. says nothing about vegetables and so on. It talks about the animals, and it says there are some of them you can eat, there are others that you can't. One writer puts it this way. He says, to be holy, distinctive, and priestly in character was not an abstract ideal, but an attainable reality that had practical dimensions in everyday living. That's what God was setting out for Israel then, saying, you can live in this way. I will set it out for you. This is to show you what is acceptable to me. But also that these things, while it concerns with everyday life, it was in order that they should be acceptable before God in ceremonial things. That it's depending on what you eat, then you would be able to come to God. There are things that you might touch, might eat, and that would prevent you from coming to God. They do have an impact on religion, the Old Testament religion. I think the other thing that we perhaps might assume, if we even get that far, sometimes we will read something like this and we miss one glaringly obvious issue in front of us. And this is found in chapter 11, verse 1, as well as other parts. And it is simply this, that the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron. The Lord had direction to give to his people. The comment was made that this is not just that Israel had sort of lived through a whole many years and had worked out folklore and wisdom, certain kind of wisdom that certain animals were suitable and others were not. This was God on a clean slate, so to speak, setting out very plainly what was acceptable and what was not. These are God's directives for Israel with exactly the same strength of the other commands that he's given thus far, many of which we've looked at. And I say that's glaringly obvious, but we miss it. It should be right in front of us, and it should be there all the time. And some of it is the sort of area in which Israel failed time and time again throughout their history. And that means they were disobedient, not just going their own way, ignoring good advice, ignoring conventional wisdom, but they were ignoring the command and the directive of God. Now, just a few characteristics of this. You'll find perhaps the clearest statement is in verse 3 of chapter 11, what you can eat are the things that have two qualities. One, divide the hoof, they have a cloven hoof, and chew the cud. The examples of these, of course, are cattle and sheep. The hoof, if you look at them, has a split down the middle, and it's divided right through to the back. Two pieces. And they chew the cud. They have multiple stomachs. They're ruminants. The grass comes back up, and they chew it over again. Now, these were the two things that God said had to be in place. And a number of examples are mentioned of perhaps slightly confusing animals that needed to be clarified. Maybe there are various examples as well. They're most probably animals that would have been used by other people around them. But God is saying, no, these things you may not use. They have one of these qualities, but they don't have the other. Don't touch them. Both of them were necessary. Now, coming to this, the other examples, the fish and then the birds. Incidentally, notice the birds, by and large, you will find that they are, what do we call them, carrions. Carrion vulture is one that's mentioned there. They're meat eaters. There are also insects, and there's quite a distinction between those who will run on the ground, like ants perhaps, and those who can jump or even fly, like the locust. And you might ask yourself, well, why all of this? Is there something that we can learn for today even? Well, I think just to start very briefly, one thing is that, yes, this kind of standard would be very distinctive. The swine, for example, pigs, were often used by other people. I mentioned that already. The hare, for example, as well. So it would certainly have made Israel quite distinctive. But a number of the writers about this, who I think we do have to respect greatly, they've tended to come to the conclusion that a lot of this is to do with what we today might call being clean. It's hygiene. This is healthy eating. And God was setting out here an agenda for a very healthy diet, if you have to eat meat at all, of course. This one writer goes through this in great detail. He talks about some of the medical conditions and the bacteria and things that have been discovered in modern science. And all of it backs up exactly this distinction that is set out here in Scripture. Now, Israel wasn't to know these things. They didn't have microscopes. They couldn't find out some of these things. But God knows them. God knew what was there. He knows the viruses and so on that could be carried, long before any of us ever would, even with modern science. And do you remember Daniel? Yes, he seems to have concentrated on vegetables when he was a young man and he was being tested in Babylon, being prepared for the king's service. After a short period with a very distinctive diet, Daniel turned out with his friends to be far more healthy than all the rest who are eating these rich foods, typical foods that are being prohibited here. It's not foolishness. It's not just an arbitrary division. There's a lot of wisdom in this, which of course we should understand since we remember it is God who is speaking. And so a literal physical cleanliness is a significant part of this distinction that is made here, I think. Just keep that in mind. I'm going to double back on it as we wrap up later on. The next section deals with animals more generally, not just about food, but even about touching certain animals and carcasses. We didn't read that section. I need to just give you a quick glance at that as well. It may be understood that this is largely concerned with ceremonial defilement. These animals, when an animal is dead, death is an unclean thing. And yes, there is something of that there as well. But again, we need to realize that there is a real possibility of a physical contamination from these things. Remember where Israel is, the Middle East. It can be a very warm climate where they were, these animals, no refrigeration or anything of that sort. There'd be physical contamination could come about very quickly. Hygiene is also something that's important in this area. Again, to quote the same writer, he says, the scriptural correlation between physical and spiritual health. It's physical health that is there in the first place, but there's a correlation, a connection between them throughout Scripture, he's saying. It's not always either noticed or followed by the Christian. I mention that because it is something that we need to think about. How do we go about our lives in every simple aspect? This is about, there's a dead animal there. How do we deal with it? That's what they had to be concerned about. Are there things in our lives that are not appropriate for someone who belongs to a holy God? Now, why was it a concern to be clean or unclean? They needed to be able to go to God. And if they were unclean, what did they have to do? For example, chapter 11, verse 28, whoever carries any such carcass shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening. That's just a short spell. But these things could be even worse than that. Shutting someone out, cutting someone off, keeping them away. It was only after that, after they'd cleansed themselves, that they might then be able to approach God. And especially for the Christian, is that the way it should be? Should we ever allow something into our lives that will separate us from Him? And here it was in the physical. That's what these passages are about that we're looking at this evening. That's just a glimpse of the animals and the animals for food especially. Again, I want you just to remember a little of that that I want to refer back to later on under the New Testament connections. Just to take you on a little further, in chapter 12, there is a ritual after childbirth, and then in chapter 15, there are rituals concerned with different discharges. Just to speak for a moment about childbirth, there is, I think, a legitimate question coming to this, because as it's presented here, you'd almost think within this setting that there's something wrong with it. Why is there a need for cleansing? Isn't it a good thing? The Bible itself speaks of the birth of a child is a great blessing. Why is there a need for atonement? Mentioned in verse 7. He shall offer it before the Lord and make atonement for her. Why should that be necessary? Well, again, this is, I think, another area where it seems to indicate that all of this is about very literal things. It's not just about giving a spiritual picture. You see, when a child is born, there's a great deal of blood around, and this is something that is very precious to God. It belongs to God. There is an uncleanness for a time. There needs to be a realization that this is, while it is, yes, a blessing, and the child does belong to God, but there is still a need for a purification. It actually comes up later on, but I think it could be mentioned here as well, that there are days of purification for the mother. And this would be something that was, I think, shows God's great grace. The mother is pretty knocked up after her birth, and she had time to be apart for quite some time after giving birth to the child. And certainly in those days, mothers, women, would have been working very hard. And it was, along with the necessary purification, it was also a provision of God, I think, for them, that they could recover from that wearing experience, that labor. Just by the way, there is also mention in this chapter as well of the eighth day, the child, the male child, would be circumcised. And again, scientists today have realized that circumcision is best done within a very small gap of around about 6 to 10 days, and that eighth day is just on the spot, even just from a very purely physical perspective. The ideal timing is set out by God. Do it on the eighth day. Israel doesn't know these things except by God's direction. God is very gracious in setting them before them. Chapter 12 is short. Chapter 15 is a bit longer, and it talks about various discharges. Again, perhaps we might feel even a bit uncomfortable reading a chapter like this. It seems so down to earth, so earthy, as we might say. It's talking particularly about there's male first, and then there's also female. Let's just use the word discharges at the moment. They're normal and there's abnormal in both cases. Something that's normal, and in the middle it talks also about men and women together in a sexual union, and this is where they're both involved in this, but separately, men first and then women as well. The reason why this is a problem, why this is necessary, is not explained. It is possible that in the acute or chronic case for the male, that this unclean discharge is possibly from disease. And that disease is something that may be dealt with later on in Leviticus. Also, the abnormal and acute, the continuous discharge of the woman is something that is very unusual. It indicates ill health. Now, in both these cases, why should it be? Why should it be necessary? Yes, if there's illness, it is something that, again, physically, literally, is, shall we say, unclean. But we might also recognize that some of it is because of what we might call dead matter. There's blood also involved, especially for the female. Where there is illness, there is a likelihood of contagion, a literal uncleanness. But do notice that in some of these, there is no need for a purifying sacrifice. It's not a matter of sin, but there are rituals involved for cleansing and washing. And again, we find that the woman who is in the normal course of events, the monthly discharge, that she is provided for. She's been set apart for a period when she can recover as well, be relieved from the demands of normal life. But again, very much hygienic considerations are very strong through all of this. In the middle of these, I've just had to quickly go through that, and I also very quickly go through an even bigger section, chapters 13 and 14, dealing with what is called here leprosy. A leper today has a particular disease. Leprosy in those days, as it's described in these chapters, is a more comprehensive title, and perhaps the best thing would be to talk about leprosy here as afflictions on the skin, on the surface. And I say surface deliberately because some of this also concerns not just bodies and skin, but it concerns clothing, even walls in a building on the surface of these as well. And there can be varying severities. Some may eventually be very severe. And it's been likened to the sort of more overarching term that we have today of cancer, where it can be of all sorts of different varieties and strengths and so on. That's where a large part of this comes in, that where a man has, in verse chapter 13, verse 2, on his skin of his body a swelling, a scab, a bright spot, it becomes on the skin of his body like a leprous sore, then he shall be brought to Aaron the priest, or to one of his sons, the priests. And it was the priest's responsibility to provide a diagnosis. What is exactly the problem here? And the Lord sets out a very strict order of standard for examination that he has to work through. It's not just for the priest to take a guess at it and to make a decision, but very deliberately to work through certain standard questions. And it goes into a lot of detail, which in a service like this, you and I just don't have the time to read. But it's all there to show the priest how to do it. It was really a medical lesson for him. He was to be the physician. He was to give some examination of the sick person, the patient. And initially the treatment was to make an initial declaration for a short period whether he was clean or unclean. And if he was unclean, he was to be put in isolation. Again, this is in the first place a matter of hygiene. It was to preserve the community until there could be a further checkup. A week later, the priest would meet with this leper, let's call him that for convenience, and he would determine whether it had got worse or got better and come to a clearer diagnosis. And as the story unfolds, as you work through these various examinations, you eventually come to the point where a man, after due care, deliberate care in this examination, a man is then declared a leper. He shall be pronounced unclean. In chapter 13, verse 44, he is a leprous man. Now, do notice that what God has set out here is to say to the priest, be careful how you go about it. Don't prematurely condemn a person to what is to follow. But at the same time, there's the necessity for preserving the community. That is, that eventually a man who had not healed, who had only got better, what was to happen to him? We read those couple of verses, 45. The leper is to tear his clothes and his head is to be bare. Now, if you haven't heard this before, do remember when it comes up again that this is a signal of mourning. This is a signal, really, of the one who mourns over death. And that's what was to happen to him. He was to be sent outside the camp. He was to dwell alone. This was a community people. Individuals belonged in the community. But for the preservation of the community, this man would be sent outside as long as he was unwell, and as long as he had this leprosy on him. He was to be banished. It was a living death, no longer to stay there. And that means not only a physical separation, but it was also made it impossible for him to continue in spiritual fellowship, either with God's people or with God himself. If he couldn't come into the camp, he couldn't come into the tabernacle to offer sacrifices. It was completely impossible for him. It was a living death. I think we need to appreciate that, what leprosy was about in the Old Testament. What does appear later on in chapter 14 is a ritual for cleansing healed lepers. Now in this case it would begin with those who were initially under that general heading of leprosy, who maybe had something much less severe, and within say a week or maybe another phase they did recover. But there was also the possibility for one who was banished outside, who could then be restored. And again, remember the separation, what the separation meant. When that separation comes to an end, and this leper is brought back in, there are certain cleansing ceremonies that were required, very elaborate ones. But there was a time of great rejoicing for this restoration. Psalm 51, that's known to many of you, speaks of cleanse me with hyssop, and I shall be whiter than snow. Hyssop appears here in the cleansing of a leper in chapter 14, verse 4. This was one of the crucial elements in that cleansing. You would also notice that in that cleansing, he was to be blood was to be taken, and he was to be marked on his right ear, on his thumb, on his big toe. Some of you have been here before when I've been talking about the priests. that was identical to their consecration. This again speaks of the bringing together, committing life itself in all its fullness under God, in cleanness, cleansed by the blood, and for the service of God. Perhaps we should just notice a couple of little points about the cleansing of the leper, just very quickly. For example, on the law of the leper for the day of his cleansing, he shall be brought to the priest. And in verse 3 of chapter 14, the priest shall go out of the camp. It was to begin outside the camp. I don't think it's saying too much to remember that in Hebrews, the writer there, he says, Jesus went outside the camp bearing our reproach. That was the beginning of the healing work of God's people in a spiritual way. There's, I think, an intriguing symbolism here. If you were to go on further in chapter 4, notice it says, the priest shall command to take for him who is to be cleansed. Very particular use of words here. It's not that this one comes and brings his offering, his two birds and so on. He can't do that. He doesn't have these things. It's to be done for him. That was the character of leprosy. Unable to help himself, he needed help given to him. You could also notice in verses 6 and 7, it's being brought out that there's two birds. One was to die, the other was to live and to be released. Is that also an image of what is to come in Christ more fully? And then to that smearing of the blood on the leper, signaling commitment to the Lord after his restoration and healing, which could only have been by the Lord's work in his body, in his life. Well, that is just a very quick glimpse at these aspects there in Leviticus, and I just want to bring to mind a number of New Testament connections. You see, so often in the New Testament, you will read something, and it says something, and I'm not sure that we grasp the real full implications of what is in front of us there. Take, for example, there were those directives of the food and the animals. Some of those were unclean. That goes back a long, long way. In the days of Jesus, people of Judah, the Jews, were seeking, by and large, to adhere to these things. They'd gone through so many experiences where they had failed, Israel had failed and been punished for it, that they were starting to learn their lesson. And these things belonged to them. And they said, if that's the case, then we must adhere to them. There are certain animals we can eat, certain that we can't. In Acts chapter 10, Peter was up on a housetop to pray. He became very hungry, and he wanted to eat. But while he was there, he fell into a trance. And in that trance, he saw something like a great sheet, and in it were all kinds of animals of the earth, wild beasts, creeping things, birds. And the voice came to him, "Rise, Peter, kill and eat." And Peter said what we should expect from him to say, "Not so, Lord, for I have never eaten anything common or unclean." This is where it comes from, and let's never ignore Leviticus. This is where this kind of thing comes from. But what we find there in the New Testament is that this very same voice speaks to him and says, "What God has cleansed, you must not call uncommon." Back there in Leviticus, God said certain animals, they're unclean. Now he's saying, you can eat them. I'm commanding you. This is a new command. Those things are now cleansed. That, of course, was the preparation for Peter going out to the nations who were unclean, the people around Israel who were unclean. And that was the lesson he had to learn, that this is the case with the animals, that you can eat. They're not forbidden any longer. In fact, I command you to make use of them to eat. Now I'm commanding you to go to this man, Cornelius, and to say to him, there is salvation, there is hope in the grace of God. We noticed a number of other things that the Lord was speaking about, where cleansing was necessary. Cleansing was essential there, as described under God's wisdom and God's knowledge, which is being confirmed by scientific study today, medical knowledge, and so on. But of course God knew these things, didn't he? He's the one who put them into place, first of all. But there's a very interesting point in this as well. Do you remember when there was a woman who was in the crowd? We heard of this last Sunday morning, when Jesus was going to heal the daughter of Jairus. This woman came and touched the border of his cloak. She had been troubled with an issue of blood, it's described as, for 12 years. This is the kind of, shall we say, abnormal discharge that we've been talking about in chapter 15 of Leviticus. She was unclean, and she knew it. Surely this was a painful thing, not just physical pain, but the pain of uncleanness and the separation that would bring to her. In the prophet Haggai, the Lord speaks through his prophet and says to the people, if food is touched by an unclean object, is it made unclean? And the people answered, yes. Then he said, if it's touched by something holy, one of the consecrated items of the temple, for example, is it made clean? And they had to acknowledge, no, it doesn't work that way. But here it's different. This woman was unclean because of the issue of her blood. Yet Jesus had a holiness which was undefiled, which did work the other way, which came to her and transformed her and healed her. Where was the healing to come from for these people in the days of Leviticus? It was to be God's work. This was Jesus again demonstrating his divinity in his security and his holiness, that it was undefiled. And just the same when it comes to leprosy. This is another thing that people, the lepers had to be isolated. One, that they were not contagious. Two, that they were quite simply unclean. When Jesus met with a leper, the leper came to him, implored him, said, if you are willing, you can make me clean. What did Jesus do? Another story, Jesus spoke and they were cleansed. He sent them on their way. But this time Jesus was moved with compassion. He put out his hand and touched him. And that must have been the most remarkable thing that leper had ever known for many a year. When he'd been isolated, separated from all people, he had to shout unclean so that they would stay away from him, least of all at arm's length. Here Jesus reached out and touched him and healed him. I am willing to be cleansed. Jesus transforms all these things. Those things in the Old Testament were necessary for them. Jesus transformed them. But he didn't bring down the structure of cleansing. Those lepers, several incidents that we read of, on each case he said to them, now go to the priest and let him pronounce you clean. Go through the cleansing rituals. To that point, the priest's role was still necessary and valued by the Lord himself. He was not undermining what was set in place there. He was just so much greater. He was God himself amongst men, who could transform the men themselves. So just with that glimpse, to be reminded of the issue of cleanliness, purity, and how uncleanness separates from God. That's what so many of these things are about. They couldn't partake of ceremonial rituals or anything while they were unclean for any of these reasons that we've touched on. Separating from God. If we're to have fellowship with God, it must be on His conditions, His grounds, must be in cleanliness. That was what was necessary then. That was the way that the Lord provided for His people. Even through ordinary things of life, that they were preparing themselves to deal with God and to walk with Him. But now, of course, it's on a different basis. Paul says in one place, he says, take all things with thanksgiving. And that should tell us something. You can't give thanks except in relationship with the God that we're dealing with. And if our heart is in relationship and fellowship with Him, then the detail no longer remains important. God has cleansed these things through Christ Himself and His coming amongst men. This is just part of the story. I trust and pray that the Lord will bless it to each of us also this evening. Let us pray together.